Hi, welcome back to episode 49 of the Guru Performance We Do Science podcast. And today I have Dr. Dan Ogborn. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm good, mate. I'm good. So, I'm not sure how this is working out this way, but I seem to have a lot of people, a lot of experts from Canada who are either Canadians or based in Canada. I believe that you're going to continue this trend lately. So do you want to just tell us a bit more about yourself and where you're based and your sort of research interests?
Sure. So I guess right now I'm in Southern Ontario working in Hamilton. I just wrapped up my PhD at McMaster University. Mac is kind of like what I think is the hub for kind of the top-notch kin research in Canada. Stu Phillips, who I'm sure most of your listeners are familiar with, he works there.
He's been on a few times, actually.
Yeah, that's right. And my advisor, who I consider kind of to be one of the modern, I don't want to say grandfather because he's not that old, but of exercise physiology is Dr. Mark Tarnopolsky. And you'd be hard-pressed to find a solid ex-phys paper that doesn't have his name somewhere in the author list right now.
Yeah.
So I spent the last few years working with him. And while I was there at McMaster, I was actually teaching in the physiotherapy program. I was teaching anatomy, and I got hooked. So after I finished up the PhD, I figured I could tack a few more years on to the end there. And so I postdoced with Mark for a little bit while also doing my physical therapy degree, and I'm just in the process of finishing that up right now.
Brilliant.
Yep. And so from a research perspective, I don't know if this is a good thing to say about yourself, but I consider myself to be a bit of a jack of all trades and master of none. And that's because I've literally gone from, studying the effects of the methylation of specific genes, transcript abundance, so kind of the molecular side of exercise physiology. And now because while I'm doing this other program, it's kind of hard to do a lot of those techniques when you have to work in an ICU for 8 hours at the same time. I've been doing some more of the applied research, and I've done a few collaborations with Brad Schoenfeld right now, kind of looking at the more practical aspects of the research world.
Great. Yeah, well, Brad, you mentioned some names there that a lot of our listeners will be familiar with. Brad's been on quite a few times, actually, and I've met Brad personally many times. He's great, and we'll actually come back to some of his stuff in a bit. But Tarnopolsky. Now, I actually attended a lecture by Mark Tarnopolsky. He spoke actually at one of the ISSN conferences last year in Florida. Mm-hmm. And what struck me is that guy, the speed at which he delivered the lecture and the level of detail was genius. And I know that you're going to be people would accuse you of being biased, but I would say that you're an awfully lucky man to have had him. He's an incredibly rare academic, and he's a medical doctor, isn't he? And
he's got a full MD. He does a lot of mitochondrial medicine and deals with kind of myopathies.
Yeah,
runs a full research practice. I think he started some companies on the side.
Wow.
I think the one advantage of working with him is that you will never call yourself busy after that. So
yeah.
See what he manages to accomplish in a day, then you realize, okay, I got to up my game.
That explains why his lecture was so fast. He packed two lectures into one. It was incredible. About creatine, but the health aspects, which is mind-boggling stuff. So maybe I'll get him on at some point. So look, there's all kinds of things we could get into, and I think what's clear to listeners is my interest in this is, I'm not the expert, you guys are the experts, although I've been a practitioner a long time. I've started off in the wild west of practitionerdom, doing all kinds of quacky stuff and not really knowing what I'm doing, and sort of on my own journey, I've managed to get the right information finally from the right places, and that's why I get to talk to you guys, and my biggest interest is sort of grabbing this science, talking to guys like you who are actually doing the science and then unpacking this science into the real world so that we can see how this informs practice. And that's really why I like what you're doing. You mentioned Brad Schoenfeld. He's most of his work, or all of his work, is incredibly useful from an applied perspective, as has many of the others that we've mentioned and have been on this podcast. So to switch gears then, let's get into a couple of topics that I know you know quite a bit about. And there's a few papers that I've read lately that there's one that I think's in press, which is to do with the acute mitochondrial response to unaccustomed resistance exercise. Now, I wasn't initially that interested in sort of mitochondria and so on, because like most people who haven't acquired the sort of, you know, education in molecular biology and so on as it relates to exercise sciences, you don't immediately realize the importance of things like molecular signaling and upregulation of enzymes and all this sort of stuff that we've discussed with all kinds of people on this podcast. Everyone from Lee Breen, Lee Hamilton, Keith Barr. I've had them all. It's been absolutely fascinating. And I've even had James Morton, who's obviously from the UK, where we've talked about various implications of manipulating carbohydrates, for example, for the purposes of, amongst other things, mitochondrial biogenesis, with obvious implications to endurance, even metabolic health, that sort of thing. But we never really relate this conversation or this focus to resistance training. So that's why I'm really fascinated. So what first led you guys to study that?
Yeah, I think I agree with a lot of what you said. And I think what we've seen kind of in the strength training literature, and the one that always comes to my mind is if you look at the National Strength and Conditioning Association, their textbook, when most people think strength training, they think back to the diagrams in those textbooks, and they think, well, if you when you grow a muscle cell, who needs mitochondria? If anything, you reduce mitochondria with strength training, and they quote the kind of principle of specificity. And so everyone associated mitochondria with endurance training and strength training with hypertrophy, and not realizing that there has to be connections between the two. I mean, mitochondria are the source of energy within the cell. Obviously, hypertrophy is an energy-consuming process, and so there has to be connections between them. And what was often thought was that, you grow these muscle cells, and your mitochondria become more dilute. And the evidence we had for that was just kind of a few studies in the 70s and 80s that, you know, they're because back then it was a different time, they weren't very well described, and so the evidence was very weak. And so when I started with Mark, he's obviously very interested in mitochondria. I'm strength training through and through. And he was doing work looking at the concept known as gene shifting. And so a lot of people don't realize that, and there's debate as to the origin of mitochondria in kind of human cells, but it's thought that mitochondria resulted from the fusion between endosymbiotic bacteria and eukaryotic cells, you know, millions, billions of years ago. And because of that, what we don't realize is that mitochondria actually have their own DNA. So if you look within a muscle cell, you've got nuclear DNA within your nucleus, and mitochondria have their own DNA, which encodes certain proteins that are required for mitochondrial function. And kind of in the last, I'd say 50, 70 years, we've had what's known as the mitochondrial theory of aging. And I'm sure some people have heard of this because it's pretty popular, but basically it's a vicious cycle where you have free radical production that damages your mitochondrial DNA, which leads to damaged mitochondrial proteins, which leads to more free radical production and more mitochondrial damage. And this has been considered one of the kind of main theories as to how we age. And gene shifting came in, maybe 20 years ago, a little less than 20 years ago, where they looked at patients that have mitochondrial DNA mutations, so they have problems with energy metabolism. And what they found is when you trigger regeneration in those muscles, you actually reduce the amount of mutations in those muscles. So you improve the quality of their mitochondria somehow. And so the question became, well, how does it happen? And as it turns out, you know, within muscle, you have your muscle fibers and you have your satellite cells, which are essentially like a committed muscle stem cell. So we can use those to repair and regenerate our muscles. Now, muscle fibers are metabolically active, right? They work. They produce force. The satellite cells are less active. And when you look at the mitochondria, their DNA is usually has less deletion. So the mitochondrial DNA is in better shape as we age in our satellite cells than it is in our muscle fibers. And so that led to the idea of if we damage muscle and we stimulate regeneration, these satellite cells fuse and generate new fibers or repair the existing damaged fibers. When they do that, they bring along their nice fresh mitochondrial DNA and they essentially give us some new DNA that's in good shape for our mitochondria and our muscle cells. Now, back in 99, there was a paper where they literally strength trained one patient with the mitochondrial DNA problem. So keep in mind, this is, you know, obviously a case study on one patient. But what they found was that when they strength trained this guy, they improved the quality of his mitochondrial DNA inside his muscle fibers. And that was associated with protein levels that are indicative of kind of mitochondrial function or mitochondrial quality. Now, in the exercise phys world, you can't get money to study exercise prescription and kind of the questions we like at the applied level. It's very difficult. So you have to tie it to a health outcome. And so this is our way of connecting the two. And so Mark had published in 2009, he had a review article talking about applying this concept of gene shifting to aging. So we know that as we get older, the mitochondria in our muscle cells, they accumulate these deletions, they accumulate these mutations, and ultimately we end up with a certain degree of mitochondrial dysfunction, or at least impaired ability to create energy. And so that was our link then. So if gene shifting worked in these patients with mitochondrial DNA deletions or mutations, could we apply it to age people in using strength training? And so that's how we connected the two.
Yeah. You know, I find this stuff fascinating for one simple reason. Well, for many reasons, sorry. But I mean, for one reason that springs to mind, which is we constantly separate people from athletes, or to put it better, and I've said this in other podcasts, you know, the thing that we do forget is that whether you're an athlete or not, we're all human beings. So athletes are human beings first, athletes second. Mm-hmm. And a healthy human being will always make a healthier or more effective athlete for numerous reasons that we could potentially touch into. And I'm guessing from what I hear from people like yourself and all the other guests that have been on, is this sort of exercise science, sports science, performance science is now moving away from just this basic concept of, you know, how much do you have to lift and how much protein do you need to consume, to all these different areas, which is clearly an exciting thing for you as a researcher, but also for me as a practitioner to consider. There are all kinds of parameters here that can be tweaked, if you like, or focused on. So to bring it back then, because that word mitochondrial dysfunction, I mean, that sounds scary.
it does.
So, I mean, what are the implications of dysfunctional mitochondria?
Well, I mean, ultimately, so your mitochondria contains a chain of protein complexes that are responsible for ATP synthesis. So that's your energy currency in the cell. That's how you're going to get work done, is with ATP. So if you have dysfunctional mitochondria, you're going to have an impaired ability to produce energy. And one thing I like to relate this to is because, again, like I said, that we tend to have this, we like to dichotomize things. So we say mitochondria are endurance, strength is hypertrophy, and there's no overlap. The problem is, and you know, we always like to use energy systems. And so when we think, okay, strength training, you know, we've got short sets, phosphocreatine, maybe anaerobic metabolism. Well, where does that phosphocreatine generated? The phosphocreatine cycle involves mitochondria. That ATP is from mitochondria. And so if you impair your mitochondria, it's not just going to affect your endurance performance. Obviously, it's affecting energy production of the cell. So any process that requires that could potentially be affected. And that's going to, regardless of what sport you're in and performance-wise, so that's going to affect strength training, that's going to affect endurance training. You know, protein synthesis is a super expensive process when it comes to spending energy. So your ability to recover is going to be impacted. So, you know, we like to apply things across groups. So while this study may have been done in untrained young and older adults, that's not to say that it doesn't have implications for the athletes. And like you said, a healthy person is probably going to be a better athlete than someone who is, you know, not in a great condition.
Sure. And I think that's relevant whether you're, quote unquote, a recreational athlete all the way up to elite or professional athlete. I mean, you know, I think it's clear that what we're hearing here is physical activity is foundational to health. You know, you see it quoted quite a lot now on Twitter and various other things. You see these sort of images of a pill with exercise written on it as perhaps the best medicine out there. And I guess this kind of research helps us to understand why training in its various forms can be so good for our health and potentially our longevity. So just because we're on this subject of training and mitochondria, I mean, how do you feel about these various sort of concepts of manipulating not just training, but also nutrition, like, for example, fasted state training that has an impact on mitochondria or mitochondrial biogenesis, for example? I mean, do you, if we relate that also to strength training, do you think that there are sort of periodization strategies that might focus on that?
You know, I think it would be difficult to say on how to structure your strength training to maximize your mitochondrial response. I think at kind of this point in time, I don't think we have a great handle on what's going on. I mean, across, you know, there's some papers by Jason Tang, who worked with Stu Phillips, and there's a few others showing that you do alter mitochondrial enzyme content with strength training. But I think, and kind of my theory is that it's more related to what the trained state of the cell is. And that's kind of what dictates the response you get to training. So if I've got an untrained individual that's severely deconditioned, I can do anything with them. We've seen this in the aging literature. You can do aerobic exercise, kind of your standard kind of ACSM guideline aerobic exercise, and you can get growth in those muscle cells. Hmm. I can do strength training in those people, and I could probably get mitochondrial biogenesis. And then in terms of someone who's already trained, I think you're going to start to see specificity in the response. And I think a great example of that, there's a kind of a microarray paper. It was from Gordon in 2011. And they basically took some individuals and they trained one arm and left the other arm untrained. You know, it was 8 weeks, so I don't think there was, you know, guys running around with one huge arm and one small arm. but it was enough to make a difference. At the gene level, and kind of what they found was when you take someone that's untrained and you give them an acute bout of exercise, you get this very large transcriptional response. So you get a lot of genes that are making mRNA that will ultimately be used as a template to make protein. And when you think about it, you've got this kind of naive cell that has no idea what just happened to it. You just put it through the strength training session, and obviously, you know, obviously the cell's not aware, but it's got to do a lot to get ready to adapt to that. Now, when you take a trained cell, maybe they've changed some of the steady state levels of the proteins that are hanging around. So they're better prepared for that stimulus. And so you see a smaller transcriptional response. And that's kind of the main thing that paper showed. But the one thing that it did show that also kind of complicates the mitochondrial argument and what agrees with what my paper showed was that when you take an untrained cell and you strength train it, you actually reduce the abundance of the mRNAs related to mitochondrial function. So it looks like, you know, you're potentially making the situation worse. You're reducing the transcripts that are required to generate mitochondrial proteins. And what my paper found was that that extends beyond mRNA. So not only do you stop making those, you have less protein around, you have less mitochondrial DNA around. So you're getting rid of some mitochondria with a single bout of strength training in an untrained individual. Now, what the Gordon paper showed was that once they were trained, that response is somewhat reduced with respect to the mRNAs that are hanging around, so the products of that we get from the genes. And so I think that was an interesting result, but I think at this point in time, we really don't know, strength training-wise, what would happen chronically with mitochondria. Now, with respect to fasted training, I mean, I don't know too much on the nutritional side. That's not really my area. If I had to guess, I would suggest that if you're fasted and you do any type of kind of energy demanding exercise, you're probably going to amplify the response of AMPK, which is a signaling protein that's very important in kind of regulating mitochondrial biogenesis. But, you know, so I think that that could potentially augment a response, but at the same time, it also, you know, takes energy to make these components. So that's probably a question for somebody that probably deals a bit more with the nutrition side of things.
Yeah, we've gone into that. I mean, I would refer the listeners to the podcast I've done with, well, all the way from James Morton, but also Keith Barr, Lee Hamilton, and most recently the one I did with Trent Stenningworth, where we get into that sort of thing. It's just that we always talk about this from the perspective of endurance training. And you just said something which I really like the concept of training yourselves. You're not, you know, we go to the gym and we lift weights because we think we're training our muscles, but this idea of I'm going to go to the gym, I'm going to hit the road, I'm going to get on the bicycle because I'm going to train my cells, and that's mm-hmm. where you start to think more about you know, sort of periodization of your training or nutrition. What am I trying to do today? I'm going to pick up that barbell. I'm going to, you know, put my foot in that bicycle pedal. But what actually am I trying to do? I'm not just trying to put some effort into this and get fit. It's far more complicated than that. And if you actually think about the end game, what you're trying to do, that manipulates some of the decisions you need to make before you get into this stuff. It's fascinating. So one area that I think is definitely interesting here is when we talk about free radicals. Mm-hmm. Certainly when I started sort of as in my lower level as a sort of a personal trainer and whatnot, a long time ago now, but you know, my interest in nutrition and wellness and all that stuff, you're sort of saturated with this idea that free radicals are bad. You don't want to do anything to increase free radicals. You want to inhale antioxidant supplements to absolutely annihilate that free radical production. But of course, as knowledge, I mean, fair enough, back then most of us didn't know the role that free radicals have in signaling processes and that sort of thing. And, you know, I've had, Dr. Graham Close has been on a few times, but I attended a lecture of his, but we also touched on it slightly where we talked about the potential negative consequences of dampening that free radical response because of the role that they actually play in this signaling effect and consequently this impact that it can have on mitochondrial function. Could you maybe explore that a bit for me? I mean, why is free radical production relevant to this conversation?
You know, I think it's such a mixed bag, that field. I mean, it confuses me as to what way to go. But I mean, so we often think of free radicals, as bad. They're damaging this, they're damaging that. But as time goes by, we're starting to see that, well, actually, they may play an important signaling role and mediate some of the adaptations to train. And it was kind of shown that when you give if you give rats allopurinol, that essentially inhibits xanthine oxidase, which inhibits some free radical production, you actually reduce some of the adaptations to endurance training. And so, yeah, I think you brought it up that there's this potential that we think we should be taking antioxidants to fight free radicals. And in doing so, we actually impair some of the adaptations that we want. Now, one thing that I don't read this, kind of antioxidant literature that much. It's not my primary interest. But one thing that always struck me as interesting is that if I'm taking in antioxidants and an elevated amount through diet, so I'm supplementing with whatever people that do that take, I'm lessening the demand on my endogenous system. So like manganese sod, all the enzymes that we have within our cells that normally function to deal with free radicals, do they not have to do the work that they normally do because we've got all these exogenous, so we've taken in all these extra, dietary antioxidants. Do we need to use them? I don't know. And so to me, it makes sense that if I exercise, I generate free radicals, and that stimulates some of the adaptation to exercise, and specifically antioxidant defense. So we know that specific enzymes like manganese superoxide dismutase, so manganese SOD, We know that is kind of a free radical busting enzyme in our cell. There's copper zinc sod. There's multiple enzymes that we know increase with exercise, and the stimulus is, you know, to me, it makes sense, is that it's free radicals. So if we put in extra antioxidants, independent of the enzyme system, maybe that, you know, handles those free radicals beforehand, so we've gotten rid of the stimulus, and we no longer need to increase our kind of intrinsic system, the enzymes that we have within our cells. And there was a postdoc working in Mark's lab when I was there, and I kind of helped him out with some aspects of his project. But he had really mixed effects as to the effect of antioxidant supplementation, I believe. And I mean, I'd have to look at the paper again, but he even, I think, found an acute performance effect in female rats, but not in males. And so I feel like that field is actually pretty mixed. But I think the best way to handle problems like that is, you know, you're trying to solve a problem, is there's obviously an outcome that you're interested in. You should be measuring something. So if you're blindly taking antioxidant supplementation in the effort that it's going to somehow alleviate this elevated burden of free radicals you've accumulated somehow, well, what outcomes are you measuring that are telling you those things, and how are you going to get any indication that what you're doing is having an effect on those outcomes? And if you can't measure it, at the end of the day, you don't know. I mean, most people can't feel free radicals. Like, oh, you know, I'm super oxidized right now. You're not going to feel that. So,
yeah.
And so I think that's kind of the question. I think if people sat back, and I think we can use, and obviously I do molecular research, so I'm interested in it. But at the end of the day, is if you don't have outcomes that you can measure and that you can use to tell that what you're doing is having an effect on the outcomes that you're interested in, then you need to question why you're doing it and whether you should be doing it.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, that is something that I really didn't have a decent appreciation of until a number of years ago, but more recent than not, is just how important it is to learn how to interpret this science from the perspective of understanding how the studies were done in the first place, and you know, so all the different variables you need to control for. And I was in the molecular biology lab recently at Liverpool John Moores University. It's part of an event where they showed us around and looked at all this stuff, where everything from how Western blots are done to illumofluorescent microscopy, and I think I got that right. That was amazingly impressive. Cutting, you know, doing biopsies. I did my own first ever biopsy on a leg of lamb.
Yeah,
I've done it. I've ticked the box. Not really a scientist, but I mean, done it. And it's a lot of work you guys have to do. And it's difficult. I've done a few research studies myself, and man, it's difficult to do research. But at that level, so the stuff that you guys are learning is incredible. But of course, trying to, you know, translate that to the real world is difficult. And like you say, people are doing so many things in their day-to-day lives, like taking antioxidant supplements and doing exercise, and you know, and also just thoughts like, you know, one man's anaerobic workout is another person's aerobic workout, just based on how fit they are and how that exercise is relative to them.
Exactly.
Which is something else I hadn't really thought about until we discussed that recently. But to bring this back on point then, I did a podcast with Lee Breen, a Brit, of course, but in our Canadian theme, I believe he did his postdoc at McMaster.
He came through McMaster. You can't get away from us.
We talked a lot about protein and sarcopenia and those sorts of things, and definitely recommend that the listeners go back to that podcast because it was really interesting. And again, you know, athletes aren't just human beings; they're also human beings at age, and we all want to be fit and healthy for as long as possible. And there's no reason why you can't be an athlete in your 80s, you know, and there are many out there that are fit. But this idea that aging muscle responds differently to youthful muscle, and therefore older or younger mitochondria, you know, has has a factor to play here. But I mean, how does age play into this topic?
Well, I think that's an interesting question. So from the work that, you know, we were talking about at the start with my most recent mitochondrial paper, ultimately what we found was that if you look at the mitochondria of the older guys in the study, yeah, they weren't of the same quality as the young guys, but the actual response over the, you know, 48 hours following that strength training bout was the same between groups. And what we had anticipated was that we would see kind of mitochondrial biogenesis, so creation of new mitochondria in the older guys, and we'd probably see probably nothing in the young guys. And of course, what we found was that they both decreased their content acutely. So that was counterintuitive to us. In terms of kind of, and this is, I think, a very important question, is how do you adjust your programming to account for differences in age? Or do you need to even do that at all? And I think what hasn't been realized is that the samples that we used in my study were actually generated from a larger study that we collaborated with Dr. Johnny Parisi, who's a professor in kinesiology at McMaster, and his student at the time, Brian McKay, who since graduated, so he's in the PhD club now as well. They did a paper looking at how the satellite cells respond in these guys to that same bout of exercise. And what they found there was, for the listeners, satellite cells, I said before, kind of like muscle stem cells. When you strength train, what happens is certain satellite cells proliferate, so they make new satellite cells. Some satellite cells differentiate, so they turn into muscle cells, and they can fuse in with muscle cells, and they're used to, you know, help repair muscle. And what they found was that when you strength train, you have a proliferative response. So you roughly double the number of satellite cells. In the young guys, that happened at 24 hours. In the older guys, that happened at 48 hours. Now, it's kind of hard to put a number as to how much satellite cells contribute to kind of hypertrophy of muscle, or at least the repair or regeneration or recovery of muscle following kind of a damaging exercise bout. I can't say, oh, they contribute 10%. And so these older guys, you know, will be impaired. But what we can say is that it took more time. And so while they may be able to repair and recover to the same level, maybe it's going to take longer. So that means maybe they need more rest. So maybe it's every other day for them, whereas a younger person, I mean, we're certainly seeing now that a lot of guys just kind of anecdotally are really doing some very high frequency, you know, squat every day, and they're getting away with it. But maybe once you're over 65, maybe you can't be doing that. And I mean, I don't think I can squat every day right now myself, but.
No, I've tried that actually for about a week. Needless to say, I'm still sitting down.
Yeah. Falling into chairs.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, people talk about specificity. So what if you work and you're lifting blocks every day and you need to save your back, which means adopting a decent squat, you know, what happens? Yeah. Eat more protein, that's definitely one thing.
That's right. In terms of the high frequency training,
yeah,
you know, we like to focus on single variables. So when you say hypertrophy, everybody says volume. When you say strength, everybody says load. And that's true to a degree. But what I think is more important is the relationship between the variables. Mm. And so, I mean, obviously with program design, you know, frequency, intensity, time, type, you know, your fit principle. But those guys that are squatting every day, something's got to give. So maybe you're training with a greater frequency, you're reducing your volume, and you're able to maintain your intensity. I mean, I don't know. I think I could probably, if I played with it, find some permutation of variables that allowed me to do it. But,
yeah,
I mean, it's also that takes a lot of time, too.
Yeah, well, you know, this podcast will exist, hopefully, for years to come, so we'll come back to that one. So that, actually, that's a great segue, because, and it's not unrelated, because we could talk about the mitochondria thing for a lot longer, but I would direct people to your paper that's, I think, shortly to come out. I think it's in press, isn't it? So...
I'm
going to be creating some dedicated pages per podcast very soon. I've been saying this the past few podcasts, but it is going to happen, and we'll put links to the papers there. But
it's a lot of work, though, too.
It is. Oh, man, is it? But, you know, it's worth it. And
for sure. Yeah, it'll definitely come to handy.
Yeah. So, Brad Schoenfeld did a paper that you co-authored along with James Krieger. I've had James Krieger on this podcast as well, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you did a systematic review on the effect of repetition duration resistance training on muscle hypertrophy. And I think this is another really fascinating topic, because you do get a lot of people who swear blind that they've got their special recipe for strength or for hypertrophy, or, you know, and a certain amount of reps and sets, you know, equates to one outcome, and a very different set of numbers relates to another. I mean, tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, I think it's actually, you know, a big problem, and I've been kind of vocal about this on Twitter, is the fact that in the training world, you have people that make very, very specific recommendations, and that, you know, that these have apparently very specific effects on their outcomes. And, you know, you're always left asking, well, where's the evidence? And when you're trained in science, right, you know the experiments that would have to happen, you know, to validate these concepts. Mm. And, of course, that, you know, it's pretty easy to tell that it hasn't been done. And on the flip side, we also know why, and I don't want to discount experience. I mean, I train people as well. I know I've done something and I've gotten an effect. But when you do something on one or two or even 10 or 20 people, you know, or hundreds of people in your practice, you don't control for everything. And usually what happens is when people are talking about the superiority of their training methods, they're making a comparative statement, having never directly compared their methods on equivalent grounds to another method. So you know that the evidence just, it's not there. And I think, you know, with the paper that, you know, we're going to talk about now, but just kind of the hypertrophy field in general, last 5 years of hypertrophy research is basically saying everything we knew, those specific recommendations we have, they're off the table now. Mm. There's so much more flexibility that you have in your hypertrophy training than we thought. And so, you know, Brad and James and myself, we looked at tempo. And I'm not going to lie, it is hard to do a meta-analysis in the ex-phys world. You know, I've also been hanging out in clinical circles now doing this degree, and I think that the clinicians have been much better at formulating systematic reviews and meta-analyses. They've got criteria in place that allow you to, you know, really assess the quality of the evidence that the recommendation you're making is based on. And that's essentially what we're doing. I think ex-phys kind of evolved from physiology, and physiologists are very good at interpreting kind of the graphs and the data. The clinicians are very concerned with how that data supports the recommendations they make to their patients.
Yeah.
And so now ex-phys, we're in the middle, right? We're taking those systematic reviews and meta-analyses, but we're using them to make recommendations, and we haven't brought in all the tools we really need to power that. And one of the problems we encounter when we do these meta-analyses is people don't realize that the science is always a work in progress. It's an iterative process. So some of the studies are of low quality. That doesn't mean we throw them out, but we have to acknowledge how the quality of that evidence supports our recommendations. And I think kind of the big area where that comes out in our world is all the myth busting we have to do.
Yeah.
And I've always kind of joked that, well, all the myth busters that we have today, how many myths are they creating for tomorrow to bust, right? You're always in the job, because the evidence base is you know, always changing. Yeah. And I think in the ex-phys world, because we don't acknowledge how the quality of the evidence impacts our ability to really establish what the effect really is, that's why we see this shifting and whatnot. Mm. But for the tempo study specifically, you know, we screened a lot of studies. I think it was 500 plus studies, of which we ended up in the 8 to 12 range actually being analyzed. So that met our criteria. And I wasn't surprised. I kind of been through the literature before, and I had written a blog post on it that, you know, because everyone in the, if you search tempo and hypertrophy, what you get is that you should lift with slow tempos, and not necessarily super slow, you know, not, although of course there's the super slow movement, but people suggest that lifting weights fast is not appropriate for hypertrophy. When you look at the evidence that's out there, kind of the effect sizes that we have, I mean, they don't support a difference between tempos. And that's kind of within the range of like a half second to 10 second per phase of the lift. And I think that's important. So that's basically saying, and it's not that I'm saying that people that lift slow are wrong. What we're saying is if you're within that range, you're probably okay. So if you're anywhere within those tempos, you're going to get the effect that you need to have. And there's no advantage of a 1 second concentric or a 4 second eccentric. I mean, the data is not there, and the data that is there doesn't support a beneficial effect of either one over the other. there was kind of a small difference in effect size. You know, if you look at kind of the faster tempos with heavyweights and faster tempo with lightweights, they did have larger effect sizes than kind of the slow tempo, which would be greater than 8 seconds in that study, and medium, which was 4 to 8 seconds. But when you look at the confidence interval, so kind of the spread of that data, a lot of them overlap. So you can't necessarily be certain that they're really that different from each other.
Yeah, I one thing I liked about that paper was the fact that you really spelt out what was involved in your inclusion criteria and, you know, how you threw things out. And I like that because, of course, you know, we read papers. Like I used to do, I used to be a real abstract reader, just read the abstract. You know, it's not until I was taught that I need to read the methods and, you know, really get into the paper and really start to understand a few things that helps you understand how reliable that outcome, you know, that conclusion actually was. And that's what I loved about it. It allows the reader to trust what you guys are saying.
Yeah, so now what we do is there's kind of frameworks in place. There's checklists that you can use as a reader. Mm. I think one is called AMSTAR, AMSTAR. You can pull those up and you can use those when you're reading a paper just to see what they look like. So are they reporting what they should be reporting? And it's important to treat a meta-analysis in a systematic review just as you would treat participants, and how you would display your methodology when you did an actual study on people or on animals. You need to have that same kind of information there. Just instead of having people or animals as your participants or as your research subjects, you have papers now.
Yeah. So just let me ask you a question then. I mean, I have had Brad Schoenfeld on, and we've one of the times he was on, we reviewed his classic paper about mechanisms of hypertrophy.
Yeah.
And, you know, at the end of the day, people get bogged down too much on this business of, like you did in this paper, you know, how about the tempo, how important that is or isn't. I've seen people worrying about, about their form as it relates to things like pennation. just shut up and lift. Just. Actually, the first thing you need to get your head around is actually exercising, or in this case, lifting. You've got to do it properly. Form is very important, particularly for safety. But if you're only training once a week, that's probably a bigger limiting factor than whether you're training fast or slow 4 times a week. What do you feel is the sort of, in order of importance behind this?
In terms of for hypertrophy, in terms of what you need to focus on?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you kind of nailed it. I mean, if you're sitting at home refreshing PubMed, waiting for a paper to come out to tell you what to do, you're never going to amount to anything physically in the gym. It's not going to happen for you.
Yeah.
I kind of hinted at this before, is that we like to say, okay, you're training for hypertrophy, you focus on volume. Training for strength, you focus on load. And I think those simple kind of rules of thumb are helpful to a degree. But, you know, with respect to hypertrophy, because that's kind of what I've done the most work on recently, I think to me, it's can you create the program that you're going to execute?
Yeah.
And I think the research we're seeing now, so we've seen that you've got flexibility in tempo. You've got 0.5 to 10 seconds, maybe even beyond that, but we don't have the literature on that yet. But you've got, lots of room there for training intensity. You know, Stu Phillips, his students Nick Bird at the time, and Cameron Mitchell, their low intensity hypertrophy papers set the groundwork to let us know that, you know what, you know, maybe we don't have to train at a high intensity all the time. It's important to acknowledge those studies were done in untrained, and now I collaborated with Brad again, and we've got a paper showing that low versus high intensity training, that same relationship plays out in guys that are trained as well. So you've got flexibility in training intensity. Rest intervals, there's a review article. I think, I'm quoting Brad Schoenfeld and Stu Phillips nonstop today, but they're the ones doing the work, so what am I going to do?
Yeah.
Schoenfeld, I think, with Mino Henselman, who I think has been on your show again as well.
Yep.
You know, they did a review on rest intervals, showing there's great flexibility there as well. And I think what this is telling us is that one is that you can create a program with the flexibility you need to get it done. I think what we haven't done a great job of highlighting in these papers is that we're equating, when we're doing the meta-analyses and systematic reviews, we're limiting our studies to those that use training to failure. And when you look at the kind of the more recent studies on training intensity, so the one that I did with Brad that just came out on the 3rd of April, that was to failure. You look at Nick Bird and Stu Phillips' protein synthesis paper to failure, Cam Mitchell's paper to failure. And so we've really got to start wondering then, how do we translate this to conditions where we don't train to failure? Or alternatively, I mean, maybe we need to start rethinking and having the comeback. You know, we all got scared of training to failure for a while. And there was, I can't remember the author right now. There's a paper that came out, I think, just in the last month or so, saying that you can get comparable growth training just short of failure. So you end up doing less work for the same amount of growth. But this comes back to what kind of has been running throughout our discussion today, is we need to consider the context of the study, the methods of the study, and how those relate to what we do in practice. So I personally am not as afraid of using failure in my training program. I've used it for, well over 10 years now. People I train with, people I've trained, you can effectively use failure in a training program. And in doing so, what you know is that you've got flexibility in those training variables. So the failure itself probably isn't, this magical stimulus that turns on growth. And what, these recent papers are showing us is it's probably not essential. You can probably train just short of failure. I personally think it has more to do with fatigue. But what failure does allow us is that it affords us the flexibility to set up our training parameters. You've got way more options when you're doing that, if you're training to failure or just short of failure. And what you need to do is find a way to do it safely and to not hurt yourself.
Yeah, and in fact, I'm pleased you mentioned context, because I always talk about context, and actually you raised it first, so I applaud you for that. I think what's clear, and I'm thinking of this both as a person who likes to exercise, but also as a practitioner, is sort of the E factor, the enjoyment factor. Yeah. And I know that, a lot of these studies are done not necessarily to try and come up with a magic bullet, but because, that's they were able to control the variables. Whereas if you want to put it into the real world, there's too many independent variables and it's very difficult to control. So, of course, things like the enjoyment factor becomes a difficult one, doesn't it? Because that depends, what day you had and how you feel and... what emails you opened that morning and what the wife said or what the girlfriend said or boyfriend or whatever. There's so many things that goes into this. And I think that we need to remember that before you get hung up on, tempo and, and even going back to the previous conversation about whether you're trying to train your mitochondria or whatever, is there are going to be other factors, which includes genetics. We talked a bit about that with Stu Phillips on one of our podcasts on the hormone hypothesis, and that was fascinating, by the way. And again, we lift information by copying or emulating people who we feel that worked for. So if a bodybuilder's doing it, who may not be admitting it, but is on a hell of a lot of juice, we can't expect that what worked for them to work for us. But we'd still try and emulate that, don't we? And that's what persists in gym culture and fitness magazines. It's, look at me. I've got the six pack. I've got the big biceps. Therefore, that is the evidence behind what I'm promoting here. But actually, especially from a health perspective, it's what you enjoy and what you're consistent with, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I've always kind of said this, I can't out-research the marketing machine.
No.
So, the 290-pound bodybuilder to people new to the field of muscle building is probably going to have more credibility than me, probably has more credibility than Stu Phillips in the eyes of some people.
Yeah.
Which, obviously to me is absolutely ridiculous. I mean, the man knows his way around a muscle. Yeah. And you're going to, you can't control for those factors, but And I think it's kind of a huge problem is and that's kind of what we have now. What I'm really interested in is we're starting to get a good handle on a lot of these topics.
Yeah.
The problem isn't necessarily our understanding of them. It's how to get other people to understand it. And I think that's what's hurting us now is how do we take, you know, everything that's out there. And so we talked about, you know, this is the myth busting. Mm-hmm. How do we get the evidence out to people in a way that's, you know, engaging, and actually gets the point across. And I think that's a difficult problem. We see a lot of battles going on. You know, vaccination's a hot topic right now.
Oh, yeah.
And just even within the fitness industry, like, you know, when I think, you know, when you look at, you had Jeremy Lanicki on.
Yeah.
Talking about blood flow occlusion. And you see the resistance to these ideas. And it's kind of like, one, you don't have to occlude to grow. If you want to, you can. But you see, these people are vehemently opposed, and they're kind of arguing with someone who's done the literature. You know, they've generated the literature. They've done the studies. They've validated their concepts.
Yeah.
But then, you know, an IFBB pro comes out and says, you know what, that's a waste of time. That's a gimmick.
Yeah.
And then all that, you know, decades of research is just gone because of that. And, you know, it's frustrating.
Well, to be fair, Dan, to be fair, If you're taking a bunch of steroids, then you probably don't need to do blood flow restriction, do you?
No, you probably don't have to go to the gym either.
Yeah, yeah.
Why bother? That's a waste of time. Yeah. And you know, that's I think that's going to be always there. You're never going to get rid of that.
Yeah.
And I think kind of as scientists and those that are concerned about informing evidence-based practices, we need to find a way to get the evidence out. And, you know, I kind of – you see it on Twitter all the time is that, you know, someone will tweet something that's, you know, probably doesn't have a lot of evidence for it. And then the evidence-based guy comes along and he says, well, you know, burden of proof, what's your evidence?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's kind of, I think it's a waste of time, you know, kind of for people in that circle to run around the internet saying, prove it, prove it, prove it. I mean, it's not getting us anywhere.
Yeah. Well, that's the whole point of this podcast is it's a way of getting knowledge from people like yourself, Stu Phillips, etc., Brad Schoenfeld, and as I said at the beginning, you know, we unpack the science but talk about it in the real world, and that sort of started off as a mission for me. You know, I was one of those people speaking BS, but as you start to learn, you go, hang on, that stuff stinks. But by recognizing it, you know, that it's education at the end of the day, and that's what we're trying to do. And the problem with some scientists is they're all about publishing into the highest impact factor journals and so on, and you know, these don't get out to the public. They're usually journals that no one can get hold of because they're subscription based, etc. And we need the science to get out there, and that's what I'm trying to do with this podcast. So listen, look, we could talk forever, but the problem is the podcast can't last forever. So I there's actually all kinds of things I want to talk to you about, so I guess we'll have to get you back.
I'd love to, anytime.
Yeah. So just so folks can learn more about you and your work and so on, I think you have a website, which is danogborn.com, danogborn.com. That's right, isn't it?
That's right, yeah. Apparently I've got a rare last name, so it's uncommon, but...
You know, depending on where we are in the world, we've all got weird names, I guess, especially me. But you've also on Twitter. I know you're on Twitter. Can you tell folks what your Twitter?
Yeah, it's just at Dan Ogborn. So DANOGBORN.
That's
same as the website.
Yeah, no, brilliant. And you know, you've got some great papers which are available. So I direct people to read those. I'd like to thank you for your time, Dan. It's been brilliant to have you on the show and share your knowledge. And I've learned loads again. I keep learning, which is why I love doing this sort of thing. I'd like to point the listeners to our website, which is guruperformance.com, where you can find the links to the podcast, whether it's iTunes or Stitcher or direct downloads, that sort of thing. As I mentioned earlier, there will be a page per episode coming soon. Please bear with me, folks, with links and information and papers and all kinds of stuff. If you want to learn more about this stuff, You clearly need to go to McMaster University. There's a lot of great guys there. And also, you can learn more wherever you are in the world or here in London via the ISSN Diploma. It's a postgraduate program. You can learn about that at the ISSNDiploma.com, also available by GuruPerformance.com. Or I am now the program leader for the Master of Science in Sports and Exercise Nutrition at Middlesex University in London, where we will also be learning about this stuff and using Dan's papers, amongst other things. So it's all great, and I look forward to bringing back another episode to you all soon. I, of course, am Laurel Bannock, and thank you for your time.